Tonight's our special guest is Katie Moffitt, recorded 9/12/17. Here's Katie Moffitt on Folk Scene on KPFK. From the Longhouse in Northridge, California, this is Folk Scene. I'm Alan Larman, along with Peter Cutler at the controls. We welcome our special guest, Katie Moffitt.
I've been a carpenter like Jesus, been a preacher like Paul, been a fisherman like Peter, I've been a liar like Saul. I've been all around this old world, been uptown and down. I know where I've been, I don't know where I'm bound. And I know, yes I know, I don't know. They say life is a river that's carrying me home. Well, I am the river, so where can I go? Time is a fire that's burning me alive. I am the fire, still unsatisfied. And I know, yes, I know, I don't know. fisherman like Peter, been a liar like song. I've been all around this old world, been a tan down. I know where I've been, I don't know where I'm bound. And I know, yes, I know, I don't know. Well, I know, yes, I know, I don't know.
Great. You can find that song on Katie's most recent release, Where the Heart Is, and it's written by your brother, you, right?
Yeah.
We'll talk about him a little bit later on. This album was a long time in the making for you, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it was actually 3 years, a little over, from the beginning of it, the actual starting of it, and having it in my hand. So that required quite a bit of patience, because I did my work on it pretty quickly, and the record was kind of basically built around guitar vocal performances.
And this is on Crossfire Music out of Canada?
Centerfire.
Centerfire,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
It was a long time between records for you.
Sort of. Although, in the middle of making this record, my brother and I made our second duet album in 3 days, not 3 years, so... So it feels like I had two records that happened at the same time. But prior to this solo studio record of mine, Where the Heart Is, I think the one preceding it was Fewer Things, I think, which would be a 08 or 09, something like that. That's a while.
Yeah. Good things come those who wait, so,
I
say.
I hope so.
Tell us about the making of this record. Who produced it?
This was produced by my pal, old friend, and great musician, producer, etc., songwriter, David Wilkie. He's got a band called Cowboy Celtic. Interesting, fascinating, beautiful band, really fun band, which is really about exploring the roots of cowboy music, of Western music, and the Irish and Scottish origins. So David had produced my one record of cowboy music, which was called Cowboy Girl, and that came out in 2001. And the guy who engineered us for Cowboy Girl had engineered all of these cowboy and Western music records. There's one little record company in Colorado Springs called Western Jubilee that specializes in Western music. Butch actually engineers most of the Western Jubilee records. And he approached me, he said, all these years later, and he said he has a studio in a freestanding building on his property outside of Denver, and he wanted to go back in to his studio with me and David and approach another project for me. And David and I were both game for it. And as soon as we started, I think it was the first day we recorded, but said he wanted to be a producer on this. And I said, knock yourself out. And he did for 3 years. So that's the cast.
How about another song?
Okay. There are several historical aspects to the songs on this record, and this is one of them. His name was Charles Howard, and he came west with the sun. Just $2 in his pocket, and he had a drive to get things done. From a bicycle repairman to the first Buick dealer man. In San Francisco, 1910, the golden promised land. Howard bought a string of thoroughbreds cowboy past his prime. But Tom Smith could tame most any bronc, and he could train the racing kind. Set a troubled horse on a losing streak, Seabiscuit was found. 1936, Howard bought him cheap at Boston Suffolk. The Biscuit ran for the men who believed in him when the rest had given up. And he ran for the 100 grand in California's coveted cup. And he ran like the wind on a common man. And he ran for the rich man too. 'Cause he ran for the sleeping victory in the hearts of me and you. Man, he jockey from Alberta who quoted Shakespeare line for line. Red Pollard had a way with trouble and he knew Seabiscuit's mine. Then from Detroit tracks to Tamperan, a miracle began. The Biscuit led from wire to wire, Adams screaming in the stand. Eastern racing was a hurricane of speed. War Admiral wore the triple crown and beat the other champs with ease. Seabiscuit was a hero on the California tracks. But out east they called him a backstretch bum. They misread was the best. It was the second civil war, this time the east against the west. They hit the bell just like a racket, they blew right off the line. And when he passed the wire, all the admirals saw was Seabiscuit behind. Oh yeah. America was struggling with despair from shore to shore. The Depression left on a little hope and gave them such a need for more. Then a broke-down horse and a third-rate jockey and a washed-up trainer man showed with a little luck and a lot of heart. You can grab that second chance. The Biscuit ran for the men who believed in him when the rest had given up. And he ran for the 100 grand in California's coveted cup. And he ran like the wind for the common man. And he ran for the rich man too. 'Cause he ran for the sleeping victory in the hearts of me and you. Man, he
this is Folk Scene. We're visiting with Katie Moffitt. Katie, you write a lot of songs from a historical perspective, don't you? Seems like.
Yeah, over the years. Over the years, I have. I guess autobiographical songs are historical to some degree. But I think really when I started writing a lot with Tom Russell is when I began approaching songs about history.
When did you first take up music?
when the Beatles came over, that's when I got a guitar. But my grandmother had snagged me when I was, five or something, and tried to teach me classical piano. I liked being around her, so I did it until I was 11. Usually, it was intense, two lessons every day, usually one before and one after school. But I never really learned how to do that.
Who took up music first, you or your brother?
It was simultaneous, I would have to say, but he was going a completely different direction. He was playing trumpet. That was his instrument. He immediately defected from my grandmother's approaches to him. All through, I guess, elementary school, junior high school, trumpet was his instrument, and he did everything. He was in lab bands and marching bands. And he was a self-professed jazz snob. So I was in the top 40 radio, and he looked way down at me. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of odd that we ended up kind of in a similar corner of Americana music and with some of the same records that brought us there, like the Gilded Palace of Sin, you know, Sweethearts of the Rodeo. But he was long gone. He was way out of the house before that happened. So it was a little bit later that we started singing together.
And we've been talking about your brother, you.
Yeah, Hugh Moffat, yeah.
And you grew up in Fort Worth, Texas?
Yep.
How much did that play a role on your musical? On your music? Texas has produced so many great musicians of so many different...
Yeah, it really has. And I think I've actually heard this story more than once, but from others growing up in Texas. But I think that my first response to growing up in Fort Worth musically was I didn't want to be anywhere near country music. But I discovered, a few years later when I was in Colorado just trying to make a living, trying to get anybody to hire me to do anything, and I ended up in some lounge gigs, I actually had absorbed some of that music without knowing it, I guess. And those are the songs that got me through those jobs, like the Marty Robbins stuff and some Waylon Jennings, old Waylon Jennings things. So you can't get away from country music when you grow up in Texas. I guess that's one part of this.
What song do you do for us next?
Give a shot to the title song, Where the Heart Is.
Until I wound up on my knees.
how I long for kinder pasture and those four worth memories. But my family are all gone. Now there's nothing there for me. A traveling girl in this broke down world, no place to call her own. Home ain't where the heart is until there's nowhere else to go. There's nowhere else to go.
Katie, how did you get signed to Columbia Records?
I was managed by a club owner in Denver. His name was Chuck Morris. That was during the rise and heyday of FM radio, underground radio. That was when the record companies found out that they could break all kinds of acts using the FM format, different kinds of acts. So Chuck's club was called Ebbets Field. It was a tiny club, but it was the top rock club in Denver for developing acts to come through. Wendy Waldman came through. That was the first time I saw her play and met her. And part of our deal, our initial deal with him managing me, was he paid me a small salary and I would play for him as an opening act anytime he asked me to. So the obvious thing to do at that point was to bring the record company heads in to see me play. And that's what he did. And it didn't take much time. It was one of those kind of unusual tales of the music business. I think there were a couple of offers, but the one that we took was from Columbia.
And you got to work with the legendary Billy Sherrill. What was that like?
Oh, man.
He kind of reshaped the whole sound of country in the 70s, it seems like.
Yeah, oh, he did. Yeah, Billy really was astonishing. He's so many different things, and he's...
When you think about records like Stand By Your Man or He Stopped Loving Her Today, it's just...
Oh, yeah. And he and Tammy wrote Stand By Your Man. He was a writer. He did so much. He was a genius, in my personal opinion. But to work with, he was one of my two favorite producers I ever worked with, and I have to say that the reason that the qualities that they shared, the other one was Steve Berlin. But this shared quality that made him great to work with for me is he was absolutely fearless. He would try anything. The fact that he wanted to produce me was, that was a stretch for him. And of course, it was an interesting stretch for me, too. I'd never done a speaking part during a song before, mm-hmm. before I made that record. But he would try anything, and he did. He would go places he was not comfortable, not familiar, but he knew what, bottom line, you know, he knew what he liked and he knew what he thought of the things, of the tracks that we cut, what he thought was going to make a great country record.
And you had some of the A-list Nashville players on there too as well, like Pete Drake and Charlie McCoy and Hargis Pick Robbins. Was it pretty daunting to be with those kind of people? I mean...
Well, it would have been if I'd had time to think about it. We did it so fast. The way it was done was, and this was kind of no longer the way shortly after I made this record, but it was done in Studio B, which was an old Quonset hut, which isn't torn down, of course, but it had the most
fabulous... Was that Rowdy's Barn, or where was it at?
No, it was in the CBS building mm-hmm. in Nashville, and there were no booths, really. Except the engineer was in a booth. There were a couple of baffles, I think, around the drums. And Larry London was on this session. Everybody. We had so many different players. Because Billy was fishing. You know, he was trying to figure this out. So there were a couple of baffles. and everyone else, and there are a lot of players on every track, and four harmony singers, and me. Everybody was in a big circle in this wild room, this Quonset hut, tall ceiling kind of space. So I would have been daunted probably, but he was so easygoing. He was so gentle to me. I was such a neophyte. And he was really smart, and very funny, dry wit. I didn't have time to be daunted because we just went in and we'd come out with three songs a day.
And for your next Columbia record, it was more of a pop record. What was the decision to do that?
I was signed on the West Coast by the pop division. They never wanted Billy to produce me. But Billy was so powerful at that time that it had to be done that way. The next record, Joe Wizard was going to produce. I waited and waited and waited, but they messed around and they didn't know I was talking to each other, and Wizard couldn't do it 6 months down the line, and nobody had talked with him about it. So Johnny Sandlin in Georgia, in Macon, had expressed an interest originally. So my guy, Ellis, the guy who signed me, said, oh, yeah, okay, go do that. And I did, and that was a great experience with some great players.
You had some of the Allman Brothers on there, too, as well. Dickie
yeah,
Betts.
Dickie Betts. Neil Larson played keyboards, and it just the Stevie Bettmeyer was one of our guitar players. It was really a terrific experience, and sonically it fit. And to me, it was really the way to go for my next record. But Ellis didn't like it, but he wouldn't really tell me that, or my manager. My manager was kind of a lame duck at this point. So it took a while, but it turned out Ellis really wanted me to work with this guy he was kind of shepherding along, who was a very accomplished arranger, and his name was Glenn Spreen. So Johnny was thoroughly insulted, and I went in again in L.A. this time with Glenn Spreen. And the reason some of those players remain on my second release is because some of the tracks that Johnny cut were remixed, and some of the parts were used on this one. But by the time it was finished, it was released only pop, and by then the record company had done one of those legal sleight of hands and decided that I was on legal suspension, which is a horrible place to be. So eventually, not soon enough for me, they dropped me when Ellis got fired. But it was interesting because I learned a lot about the music industry. I went through so many different experiences.
You hear those tales so often over and over again.
Yeah.
We're referring to your record called Kissing in the California Sun.
Yeah.
Do you think that the first record, because you weren't based out of Nashville, that was a deterrent for you? Or?
No. That Nashville division was really great, and they were strongly behind me. Unfortunately, I really think Kissing in the California Sun could have gotten some country play, but the company politics were so screwed up by then as regarded my career. So Nashville was insulted on my behalf. And I was out with Willie Nelson, who was the hottest country act in the world, and they wouldn't do any country radio time buys for me. I was insane. So, no, it was just a lack of management, really, lack of strong management, because I was a different animal entering that era of music, and it required strong management. Well, it was a great experience, I got to say.
We're talking with Katie Moffitt. Her new album is Where the Heart Is, and it's on Centerfire Music out of Canada. They can get that from your website, too, can't they? Purchase it?
Yes, that's in fact the only way it can be procured at this point.
And what's your website?
KatieMoffitt.com.
How about another song?
Okay. You had mentioned noticing a co-write with Tom Russell on this record. I'll play this one. Have you seen that Russian lady walking through the mall? She is 63 years old, and she has seen it all. She married an American, moved here in 61. He was fond of politics and owned a couple guns. And Lord, he loved Marina. They liked eating pancakes, watching Sunday matinees, as they moved from town to town in search of better days. The pretty, slow-eyed Russian girl adrift on foreign shores, staring amazement at the things in hardware stores. And how he loved Marina, with his $12 rifle and his jug of ice cream, a penny for your thoughts, Marina, a dollar for your dreams. One bright November day, after lunch she fired some rounds at a man called JFK. There was no conspiracy, no hired guns leaving town. No one believed that one rogue wolf could blow the kingdom down. But go and Marina, his $12 rifle and his jug of ice cream, a penny for your thoughts, Marina, a dollar for your dreams. Have you seen that Russian lady through the mall? She is 63 years old, and she has seen it all. She married an American, moved here in 61. He was fond of politics and owned a couple guns. And Lord, he loved Marina.
Katie, how did you meet Tom Russell?
I met Tom Russell in 1986 at the Kerrville Music Festival. It was called a folk festival back then. There was a Swiss man who was scouting for a festival. He'd begun like 2-3 years before in a tiny town in Switzerland called Frutigen. His name was Ashimura. He just died like within the last 4 weeks. But he built this festival into a monolithic American singer-songwriter international festival called Frutigen. And his stipulation, if I were to accept his offer to come play the next year, was that I work with Tom Russell's band backing me up. Tom agreed. And that's really why we began talking a lot and sending music back and forth. And eventually, the following year, when we actually did do this gig, is when we started writing.
Was that your first time in Europe, or?
No. My first time in Europe was, I think it was 77 or 78, with Leo Kottke. And in theory, the Kissing in the California Sun was being promoted. I was there to promote that record. And I was there opening for Leo, and every place we went, and we played all these beautiful old halls in the cities, and everywhere there was a CBS promo guy, the guy would show up and say in broken English, "Oh, I am so sorry, but your record's not out here yet." And I never knew if it actually ever really came out there, but it certainly didn't while I was trying to sell it. And it was, that was a notable tour for me, because all the way through Germany, which were where the majority of the dates were, they hated me. The audience hated me. And back then,
that,
oh my God. Well, it was a cultural thing, a sociological time thing, because someone finally mentioned, the promoter, I think, said, "Whatever you do, don't ever mention your record company or your record on stage. That's a no-no." It made me realize it was like the 60s in the U.S. had been. There were certain barriers that if you were to be accepted, you did not cross. But in a way, that's where the German society was at that time. So, I slowly got it a little bit, and it got a little bit better. But, man, it was a trial by fire, and Leo started referring to me as the human buffer. There had been a third act, but he got fired after the first show. He was a classical whistler. But that's another story.
Okay. After your stint with Columbia, you became a backup singer for a lot of people. Who did you sing with?
Yeah, what happened was I fired my manager finally in Colorado, and I had to go to Nashville or L.A. Nashville hadn't been very welcoming to me, and all my business structure that was left was in L.A., my agent, my lawyer, and my record company, because I was still on Columbia. So I came to Los Angeles, and my manager wasn't going to let me go unless I signed a new deal with new management. So I finally signed with the scariest guys in town, which is Steve Gold and Jerry, whatever his name is.
Jerry Goldstein?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, oh, God, yeah, yeah. And in 6 months, I realized that was not going to be okay. And no one was letting me go. And my original manager didn't drop the contract. These guys, I asked if they'd just say, you know, "We made a mistake, let's let it go." They wouldn't. So to make a living, Lynn Anderson was a label mate on Columbia, and she was passing through town, and she asked me. She just lost a singer for her touring thing, and she asked me to go out with her. And I thought, well, I'll learn how to do this for a while until these contracts expire. So that's what I did.
Who else did you sing with?
I also went out with Hoyt Axton, whom I'd done a brief thing with in 76. That was a record company fumble as well, but I loved Hoyt, and he became a mentor for me. Tanya Tucker, oh my God, we went, oh wow, that was a 3 month long tour.
What was that like?
Oh, it was amazing. It was just the entire crew, everybody except the band, was very unstable, and almost everybody who worked for her, except for the band, either quit or was fired in the course of that tour. And meanwhile, she and Glenn Campbell were in love, and he would show up all of a sudden, and we knew that because he'd walk on stage for the duets. And they broke up in the middle of that tour, and a big, bloody fight in the middle of Bossier City, Louisiana. So it was a very dramatic tour. and Tanya was, and I have a lot of respect for her. She really is a great performer. And I've admired her forever, of course, too. But she remained pretty darn stable through that whole thing.
Wow. We're speaking with Katie Moffitt. Her new album is Where the Heart Is. How about another song?
Okay. Oh, and I forgot Jimmy Buffett. I went out with him during that time, too. That was wild. Okay. Let's see here. Do you remember Jeff Rimes?
Sure, Lonesome Strangers.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know you have a song by him on there.
I do. I'm going to try to play this. I haven't talked to him since he's done this, but I think he just moved from Philadelphia to Portland. I'm too old to fall in love. I'm way over the hill. Though I wish I could say otherwise. Honey, I've been through the mill. Don't expect no sweet young thing to share my point of view. 'Cause I'm too old to fall in love with anyone but you. If you should tire of me, hey, please don't let it show. That's an aspect of reality that I don't wanna know. For without you in my life, I just don't know what I'd do. 'Cause I'm too old to fall in love with anyone but you. Boy, look into my heart. Can you see the part that's true? Yeah, that's where I keep my dreams. Now that I've been saving them for you. I'm too old to fall in love. The years have taken quite a toll. There's been a little wear and tear. Took the shine off of my soul. But I keep walking down this road, and I'm bound to see it through. 'Cause I'm too old to fall in love with anyone but you. With
anyone but you. I really like that song. It's good.
Thank you.
And you also have another record out now with your brother, Now and Then, right?
Yes.
That's the second record you guys have made together?
Yeah, the first one was, I think, 1992.
Dance Me Outside?
Yep.
Tell us about your brother.
Well, he's an astonishing guy, an asset in any situation. He started out as a songwriter in Nashville once he left. Well, he started out 3.5 years into a nuclear physics degree at Rice University and switched to English Lit graduated and became a short order cook at that point. Every parent's worst nightmare. So then he started writing country songs. Went to Nashville along with this influx of folks who, like Rodney Crowell, Don Schlitz. There were many of them. David Olney, who came in, really inspired by the fact that Kris Kristofferson was having success as a writer there. And my brother did really well. He and his now ex-wife, P.B. Siebert, wrote a couple of classics and one standard, which is Old Flames Can't Hold a Candle to You. A really great country song.
Who had the hit with that one?
A few people did. Joe's son had the first record, and that was the number 7 record. But then in 80 or 81, Dolly Parton had a number 1 record, and then everybody cut it. Merle Haggard has cut that. It's amazing how many cuts have happened on that song. He had a lot of other hits and significant ones and a presence in bluegrass music as well. Then he got remarried and then took 10 years to raise a family in a small town in eastern Washington and worked his way up to a rather high middle management position in a corporation. And then as soon as the last kid was out of the house, back to Nashville. So they're thinking about moving to Boston now. It's hard to say.
Can people get this off your website, too, as well? Or?
Now and then, yes. I was thinking about this. He just made a record a couple of years ago, a new record, wonderful one. They can get that one from him.
And your website is www.katiemoffitt.com.
Yeah.
And I should tell the spelling of your name for people who want to look it up on the web. It's KATYMOFFATT.
Yeah, that's it.
.com.
That's it. Although many, many sense of spelling can lead you to my website. Just put musician in there somewhere.
Katie, tell us about your one-woman play. What's it called?
Oh, it's called Midnight Radio, which is the song that starts the play off. And it focuses on women's stories in history and stories of my personal history. And it has a lot to do with the jumping off point, which for me, the point of inspiration for a child heading on a life path. And for me, that was the radio at midnight, Top 40 radio.
And where have you performed this?
Kind of all over and not often, but at a community college in Tennessee, at the downtown L.A. Public Library in the Mark Taper Auditorium. Then I did it in Newhall, a little theater in Newhall, California, and most recently in Tehachapi at the BK Theater with a lovely set. And the Tehachapi show was for an AAUW group.
That is the American Association of University Women.
This show actually was designed and intended to be performed on campuses during Women's History Month, which is March, and it's really attracted a lot of wonderful attention, and I enjoy doing it so much.
Can I get you to do Walking on the Moon?
Oh, my God, yes. This is one of the first songs that I wrote with Tom Russell. The lights of the town were just shutting down. The sun was fresh on the rise. I met Mama at the door. She'd been walking the floor. She says, girl, you've got stars in your eyes. Well, Mama, I was walking on the moon last night. Two loving arms held me tight, and the stars danced around so bright. When I was walking on the moon last night. Now Mama, she did weep. Girl, you've been walking in your sleep. You can't keep your feet on the ground. It's not always what it seems. Young love may be a dream, and some angels fly high just to fall down. But mama, I was walking on the moon last night. Two loving arms held me tight, and the stars danced around so bright. When I was walking on the moon last night, of the town are glowing yellow brown. The moon is beginning to rise. I kissed mama at the door, said don't worry anymore. I've seen daddy put those same stars in your eyes, and I'll be walking on tonight. Two loving arms will hold me tight as the stars dance around so bright. I'll be walking on the moon tonight.
Katie, thanks so much for coming by today. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And we tell the audience again, Katie's got two new records. One is Where the Heart Is, and the other one's a duet record with your brother, Hugh Moffat, called Now and Then. And you can find more about Katie or get these records through her website, which is katymoffatt.com. And on this last song, you're joined by an old friend.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm happy to see Rick Shea.
And I'm very happy to be here, and it's very nice to see you,
well,
Katie.
Thank you. And we've done some playing of music together in the,
yes,
in the deep past.
But yes, it's been too long.
It has. Oh, we're going to fix that right now.
Good.
Okay.
And I should say that this song also appears on your duet record with your brother.
Yeah, right on. It does. Okay. Here we go.
Keep your land trimmed and burning. Keep your land trimmed.
That was Katie Moffitt, recorded on Folk Scene, September 12th, 2017. This is KPFK.